Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com. Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.
As we wrap up 2024, the pop culture experts at Consequence are back with our annual report, celebrating the year's best in music and entertainment. And this time, we're bringing you Something Extra, a brand new podcast series exclusively on Amazon Music. Get inside access with interviews featuring the year's biggest artists, actors, and filmmakers, plus discussions with the Consequence team on our best of the year lists. You can tune in with Amazon Music Unlimited, now free for 3 months. For a limited time, get 3 months of Amazon Music Unlimited free by visiting tryamazonmusic.com/COS. You'll get over 100 million songs in stunning HD sound on demand and ad-free, plus top ad-free podcasts, including the Consequence Annual Report podcast. Even better, every Amazon Music Unlimited subscriber now gets one free audiobook from Audible each month. So celebrate the best of 2024 with Consequence's Annual Report all December at consequence.net. And don't miss the companion podcast by signing up for 3 free months of Amazon Music Unlimited at tryamazonmusic.com/COS or clicking the link in the show description. That's tryamazonmusic.com/COS. Consequence Podcast Network.
Hi, this is Moby, and I'm here giving you the story behind Why Does My Heart Feel So Bad on Consequence. Welcome, listeners, to The Story Behind the Song. I'm your host, Peter Chotti of Deep Cuts Media. In this week's episode, I interview musician, artist, and activist Moby, whose 1999 album Play spawned an endless string of iconic hits and celebrates its 25th anniversary this year. To celebrate that milestone, Moby just performed his first live shows in over 10 years. I was fortunate to be at one of them in London. Moby, whose real name is Richard Melville Harl, was given his nickname by his parents in his youngest days, based on the book Moby Dick, penned by his distant relative Herman Melville. Moby Dick is a whale, of course, an animal, so it's fitting that animal activism is central to Moby's life, in addition to his great music, including his just-released new album, Always Centered at Night. To celebrate the 25th anniversary of the album Play, I interview Moby about the song Why Does My Heart, just one of the album's standout and lasting tracks. We also discuss his process for songwriting and sampling of gospel music, which is a defining characteristic of the album Play. I also dig into two other personal favorites, Extreme Ways and Slipping Away. So take a listen as we dive deep into the story behind one of Moby's signature tracks, Why Does My Heart, from his 1999 album, Play. Moby, you're such a multifaceted guy, a true Renaissance man. You're a musician, activist, photographer, filmmaker, author of several different books. We're going to talk about Play today and Why Does My Heart, but we're also going to be talking about your new album, Always Centered at Night. So I don't know how you find the time, but you are involved in many, many different things.
What I learned about 15 years ago when I got sober is that in sobriety, I have so much free time. Before getting sober, I was going out every night, and then all the time I spent being hungover and the time I spent, you know, like 8 hours a day going out, getting drunk, buying drugs, doing drugs, being hung over from the buying and the doing of the drugs and the alcohol. And so after I got sober 15 years ago, I suddenly realized like, oh, there's so much extra time in the day. And I think that's a big part of what's led me to be at times almost absurdly prolific. And when I say absurdly prolific, I'm not speaking to the quality of what I make. Like, I'm not trying to say it's good, but I certainly make a lot of things.
Well, you're obviously underselling yourself. You've done quite well. And I'm excited to talk about your film too, because it sounds like it ties together a lot of the different strands. And that was something I wasn't aware of before I started looking into things a little bit before talking, but everything else, I was following your music from the very beginning. And so I remember very vividly, especially as we started getting into the play area or play era, and just how much impact all of your music has had since that time and on an ongoing basis. And as I said, we're going to talk about Why Does My Heart today, but I want to get into Extreme Ways. And one of my personal favorites, that Slipping Away, which I think is such a beautiful song too. And it was so fun to see them at the show. And it was your first shows, your first live shows in over 10 years. And so how did that feel to be back on stage playing your shows?
To put it in a little bit of context, when I was growing up in New York and Connecticut, I played in weird little punk rock bands and experimental noise bands, and I was a DJ in a dive bar. And so I just assumed I was going to be a philosophy professor at community college, and I was going to make music in my closet that no one was ever going to listen to. So I never expected to ever play music to an audience of more than 10 people, because that's roughly the size of the audiences I was playing to when I was growing up. I mean, sometimes even less than 10 people. I remember one of the first shows my punk rock band Vatican Commandos did. We went to Akron, Ohio to play a hardcore show, and I think 6 people came. So there were more people in the band than there were in the audience.
Yeah.
And so when I started touring in the early 90s and people started coming to see me play, it was really confusing in a really nice way, because I just never expected it. So fast forward all these many years and being on stage again, it's interesting because the perspective I have now is I've been to so many concerts from other people that what I try to do on stage is basically put something, you know, a performance that I would want to see if I was in the audience. Because, and maybe this is really pedestrian of me, but when I go to see a band, I want to hear my favorite songs. You know,
sure.
I saw Paul McCartney recently, and like every other song was a new song. And I was like, great for you that you're playing new songs, but I kind of want to hear the hits.
I hear you.
So the show that we did at the O2, I was like, okay, insofar as I have well-known songs, let me play those, because I work under the assumption anyone in the audience, that's what they want to hear. If I stand on stage in front of 25,000 people and say, now I'm going to play an 8-minute new song, that's when people go to the bathroom or check their cell phones.
So how did it feel to be on stage again?
I mean, there's that sort of riding a bike muscle memory aspect to it, because I toured for so many years that on one hand, you know, being on stage in front of a lot of people is very unfamiliar, because I've spent the last 12 years staying home and going to the supermarket and going hiking. But at the same time, yeah, that muscle memory, you walk on stage, you're like, oh, I remember how to do this. Yeah. So doesn't mean I'm, again, not to sell myself short, but it doesn't mean I'm good at it. But it's certainly something that I remembered from decades of doing it.
And you only had the shows in September. And do you plan on taking it out wider than that?
So here's the thing. I had sort of decided that I was never going to tour again, because I really like staying home. I like working on different creative projects. I have my weird little film and TV production company. I like going hiking. I like sleeping in the same bed. So about 12 years ago, I decided that's it, no more touring. And what happened was my manager tricked me, and he tricked me in the best possible way. He would come to me with these offers and he'd be like, oh, don't you want to play this show? It's really lucrative. And I was like, yeah, no, I really like staying home. And then the way he got me to do this tour in September was he said, what if you give all of your money from the tour to animal rights organizations? And I realized that was the one thing I couldn't say no to.
Yeah.
And so as a result, yeah, the profits from the tour go to animal rights organizations. And as far as future touring, I mean, who knows? This tour was great. You know, it was successful. We raised a lot of money for animal rights organizations. So maybe there'll be future touring, but at present, I'm just pretty happy to stay home and make smoothies and sleep in my own bed.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with that, by the way. And you know, I lived in Laurel Canyon for years, and it's a great place just all around Los Angeles. Los Angeles gets a bad rap, but there's a lot of great places in Los Angeles to hang out and do all that. So I totally get it. So I know that, I'm sure you've talked about it so many times, but for those who are listening out there, many of them don't know how you became the Moby is your name. So can you just give your version or your, how it all came to be, how you became Moby?
Well, apparently there's some, I was talking to someone a couple of years ago, and apparently my origin story is under question a little bit. But here's what I was told by my parents, and they're both dead, so I can't ask them unless I somehow reach them in the afterlife. So when I was born, my mother and father decided to name me Richard Melville Hall, which is supposedly based on a relationship to Herman Melville. You know, so Richard, Dick, Melville, Herman Melville. But then my parents looked at me and they realized that Richard Melville Hall is a fantastic name for a lawyer or an accountant, but not a great name for a newborn baby who looks like Uncle Fester. So as a joke, my dad said, hey, let's call him Moby. And I think he worked under the assumption that Moby would be my infant comedy nickname, and that at some point I would grow up and inhabit my actual legal name. But now, decades and decades and decades later, I'm still known by my infant joke nickname.
You know what's so funny? Like I said, I've followed your music for such a long time. I had no idea why your name was Moby. I had no idea. And I think it's just a fascinating story that it relates to Herman Melville and the book Moby Dick.
Well, most people with, you know, most single-named musicians either chose their name or it was given to them in adulthood. Whereas mine, you know, it was given to me when I was 10 minutes old, lying on a hospital bed on 148th Street in New York.
That's pretty funny. It's worked out pretty well for you. Good for you. And you had said that you were, if you didn't become a musician, you might be a theologian or a professor or something like that. Can Richard Melville Hall maybe a very, you know, more fitting name for that sort of a profession? Who knows?
Oh, I mean, I definitely, that was my other, the other career path would have been, I don't know, move to New Hampshire, teach theology or philosophy at a community college, and just sit back and live in a condo by an interstate. Like that was the other, the path that was looking at me, which wouldn't have been that bad. I would have made music. I would have had a couple of friends, probably collected comic books.
Yeah. So you were talking a little bit about your early days where you were punk band. So how did that happen where you were in these bands playing that kind of music and then you transitioned into being a DJ? And then tell us a little bit about the first gig that you remember as a DJ.
Well, basically what happened was, and this might sound overly broad, but what happened for me was New York City. I was living in Connecticut. I was 14 years old, and this was, you know, 1980, and I loved The Clash, and I loved The Sex Pistols, and I loved The Damned, and then I heard Minor Threat, and I started falling in love with the hardcore scene, and I loved early Talking Heads. And so my friends and I were little 14 and 15-year-old nascent punk rockers, and we would sneak into New York City and, you know, like hiding in the bathroom on Metro North and like, so we didn't have to pay the train fare. And we'd go to Danceteria to see the Bad Brains. Or we would go to the Peppermint Lounge to see Black Flag. And what happened was, Danceteria being the perfect example of this, it was six levels. So you'd have the Bad Brains playing in the basement. And then above that, you'd have Mission of Burma playing. And then above that, there'd be a video lounge with someone playing Gothic video, you know, Bauhaus and Joy Division videos. Yeah. But then above that, there'd be a hip hop DJ. And above that, there'd be like a gay house or gay disco DJ. And so you would just wander up and down the different floors of Danceteria. And even though you were there ostensibly to see the punk rock band, you were exposed to all this other music. And that's definitely where, I mean, like, think of the Beastie Boys, you know, they were originally a hardcore band, yeah. You know, a comedy joke punk rock band with Egg Raid on Mojo. But then they were exposed to hip hop. They were exposed to dance music. Same thing with Rick Rubin and Jean-Michel Basquiat and Madonna, even. Like, it was such an eclectic milieu. And it just became a point of pride for people to listen to everything, you know. And also, I will say, a lot of the music that, like, the post-punk that was being made then was also very eclectic. You know, think of New Order. You know, the first New Order album after Ian Curtis killed himself is quite dour, but then they went to New York and started taking drugs, and all of a sudden they started making dance music. You know, they make Blue Monday, and they made Confusion with Arthur Baker, and, like, so that the influence of New York underground dance music in the early 80s, clearly it didn't just affect me. It affected everyone from New Order to the Beastie Boys to Rick Rubin.
Yeah. I mean, look, those clubs, I remember back then in the New York days in the 80s, where the different levels were incredible. And I'm not familiar with any great clubs. I mean, I'm a little bit older now, but that have that sort of mix where you can go from different levels and be exposed to that. What an amazing experience it was to be able to have that kind of music.
Oh, and I was a 14, 15-year-old nervous little kid from the suburbs, and I realized all the cool kids were eclectic. You know, yeah. You'd go to the record stores, whether it was Sounds or Rocks in Your Head or Bleak or Bob's, and, like, the punk rockers were listening to reggae. And the hardcore kids were also listening to early hip hop. And, you know, or then you look at a band like Talking Heads. Like, the first time I saw Talking Heads at Woolman Rink, it was an epiphany. This was 80, 81, I think, 80. And I thought they were going to be playing, like, edgy stuff from More Songs About Buildings and Food or Fear of Music. And they walked on stage with an 8-piece disco band, and they played Remain in Light. And I was like, oh, I guess dance music is good. Like, all of a sudden, like, it was no longer tacky. It was dance music became exciting. And that, you know, I mean, that was definitely, like, for me, a before and after moment with being 14 years old in Central Park in 1980, seeing Talking Heads with, you know, Busta Jones and Bernie Worrell and all this amazing disco backing band.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com. Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.
What was your first real, like, bigger gig as a DJ?
The first bigger DJ gig I got, I happened because I didn't know how New York nightlife worked. And so here's what happened. I was DJing at a dive bar in Port Chester, New York, and it was great. I was playing to 30, 40 people a night, playing everything from Johnny Cash to Grandmaster Flash to, you know, just like hip hop and punk rock and Nitzer Ebb and everything. And my girlfriend at the time, this was around 1988, she said, oh, I just heard about this cool new club opening in New York called Mars, and they're hiring. And I was like, okay, great. This is my chance to finally start DJing in New York City. So I made a demo tape, and on one side was hip hop and dancehall reggae, and the other side was house music, because house music had just been invented, but I loved it. And so I took my demo cassette, and I went and stood in line with everybody applying for a job at Mars. And the people applying for jobs were, this was on 14th Street in the West Side Highway, back when the Meatpacking District was, there was nothing glamorous.
I remember that time.
It was just hookers and blood on the streets. And it was, I mean, there was nothing even remotely fancy.
Yeah.
So I stood in line with the people who were applying to be barbacks and busboys and security. And I got to the table. They had a folding table. And the woman said, okay, what position are you applying for? And I said, DJ. And she laughed in my face. But I said, well, any case, here's a demo tape. And I filled out an application form to be a DJ at Mars. Turns out the guy booking DJs didn't know that no one else was going to apply. So I was the only person who applied to be a DJ at Mars.
Wow.
And because I was the only person not cool enough to know that's not how you get a job as a DJ.
That's funny.
And this man, Yuki Watanabe, called me that day and said, oh, do you want a DJ? Because no one else applied. And so I DJed the first Friday night that Mars was open. And that was for me, like, suddenly I was in New York. I was DJing at the, and it was such a hugely successful nightclub. I mean, absurdly, you know, like 200 people waiting on the street to get in. But I lucked into it by being the only person who applied for the job.
And then how soon after that did you write Go and have that breakout moment? And integrates the Laura Palmer thing, and it was the times of David Lynch, Twin Peaks, and all of that.
Yeah, so I had been trying to get a record deal for years. In the mid-80s, I was really into The Cure and The Smiths and Echo and the Bunnymen. And so I was writing sort of Scottish, Northern English, dark, goth-inspired indie rock. And I kept sending tapes around and nothing happened. But then I got my first drum machine, you know, a Roland TR-606 and a Casio CV-101, and I started making electronic music. And again, I was sending tapes around and nothing happened. But then one night at Mars, this man named Jared Hoffman, I was DJing on the first floor, which was so exciting. And this man walked in and he said, my name's Jared Hoffman. I'm starting a record company. Do you make music? And I sent him a demo tape and he signed me. So I signed my first deal. What makes it funny is the record label didn't have a name. It didn't have employees and they'd never actually released records. So I signed my first record deal with a record company that technically didn't exist.
That's funny.
And I started volunteering and I was the office manager and I cleaned the office and I cleaned the kitchen because I was DJing at night. And by day, I was the office manager and sole employee, unpaid, of this record company. And I also set up my studio at the record company, which was an apartment on 14th Street. And I had released a version of the song Go, which was this minimalist 909 Juno 106 or Jupiter 6. I can't remember which synth I had, but basically a minimalist techno track. And it did nothing. But a man in the UK named Guy wanted to release it, but he wanted a remix. And so I came into work one day to clean the kitchen and send faxes. And Jared had taped Twin Peaks from the night before. And so before trying to work on the remix, I watched this VHS of Twin Peaks. And I heard Laura Palmer's theme and I thought, huh. What if I play Laura Palmer's theme over the remix? And that's, so the first version of Go maybe sold 500 copies. And then the next one sold close to 1 million copies because it had Laura Palmer's theme on it.
You know, that's such an amazing story. And I was just, I speak with a number of great artists, and it's fascinating and how many times I hear that kind of serendipity that comes into play where you have this song, you just happen to be given this video cassette of Twin Peaks. And for some reason that struck a chord with you, you integrated that, and that was transformational in your steps as a musician. And it's just incredible how these kinds of things happen.
Yeah, and I wonder, I mean, like, of course that still happens, but part of what happened back then is our relationship to culture, to music production, to everything. Like, you had to search it out, and there was physical media involved, and as a result, everything involves more effort,
yeah,
but also more thought.
Yeah.
You know, and I feel like, to an extent, I don't want to be an old guy criticizing contemporary culture, but to an extent, like, nowadays, every single piece of data is available instantly. And I feel like people give short shrift to, if they don't like or understand something in 3 seconds, you immediately move past it. Whereas back then, if you saved up money to buy a record, you learned to like the record. I mean, the first time I bought Public Image Second Edition or Metal Box, it made no sense to me the first 10 times I listened to it, but I only owned 6 records and I had spent money on it. So I was like, I'm going to listen to this until it makes sense.
Yeah.
And something like the Laura Palmer theme from Twin Peaks, there was only one interesting show on television. It was Twin Peaks.
Absolutely.
So it wasn't like, oh, this doesn't make immediate sense to me, so I'm going to move on to the next thing. You're like, well, this is David Lynch, and this is great, so I'm going to figure this out. Yeah, so being open to that physical serendipity and the exposure to culture and the willingness to sort of learn from culture that doesn't immediately make sense.
Yeah, no, it's so funny. I was having the exact same conversation with William Reed of the Jesus and Mary Chain yesterday. And we were talking about that. He brought that up, the same exact thing about the physical, the work it took in really discovering music and the fun, the joy in doing that and going into the vinyl, feeling the vinyl and all that. And I think there is a resurgence of that, that there's an appreciation for that. But that's fascinating about Go.
You reminded me, a couple of years ago, I sold most of my equipment and my vinyl, like basically the vinyl I wasn't playing,
yeah,
and the equipment I wasn't using. And I gave the money to a charity I work with. But I was going through my vinyl, and one of the hardest ones to part with was my first 7-inch of Never Understand, the Jesus,
yeah,
Mary Chain, yeah, single. Because boy, I mean, sonically, to state the obvious, there had been a lot of precedent for that. Like, there'd been a lot of noise, whether it was Sonic Youth or Test Department, Einstürzende and Neubauten, but the way Jesus and Mary Chain took that wall of noise and wrote a delicate pop song was so, I had never, I mean, apart from like maybe, you know, the first Velvet Underground album, I had never heard that. And it was really just being reminded how special that 7-inch was.
Yeah, he was telling me that his friend Queenie just happened to have this distortion pedal, and it was broken or something like that. He paid 20 or like 20 quid for it, and he got it, and that completely changed the sound that he was going for. So there is another great example of just serendipity. We talked a little bit about Go and how you integrated Laura Palmer's theme. Tell us about your state of mind going into the studio at that point in your life, because that was going into 1999. You have this album, you have these songs. Tell me about your state of mind and then the process of how you found these samples that you integrated into the music that permeates that album. Because it's fascinating to me. I know about sampling, but as a musician, just how you do that, like how you even think about that, you know, how in Laura Palmer seemed like it just kind of, it stuck with you, but take us through the whole process of play?
Okay. Well, so I'm going to go way back for a split second. When I was 14, I wanted to be a great singer, but then I learned I was not a great singer. I'm an average singer. You know, I'm not bad, but I'm certainly not great. And so as the 80s progressed, I realized, okay, my career path as a musician probably does not rely upon my singing abilities. And so I started thinking, okay, well, if I want great vocals on my records, I have to work with other singers and I have to find other vocals. And so I was already going to thrift shops and record stores. And at this point, lots of people were releasing acapellas, you know, hip hop records, dance records. They would release acapellas. And I was like, wow, listen to these great vocals. Let me use them. And clearly I was not alone in that. Like almost every electronic record made in the late 80s, early 90s had sampled vocals. And it became this point of pride, like whether it was DJ Shadow or The Prodigy or Norman Cook or whomever, like you would scour record stores to find these old records, you know, obscure records that no one had heard before, and use those vocals in your recording because none of us were great singers. You know, Liam from The Prodigy or DJ Shadow or Norman Cook, like none of us are going to win awards as vocalists. So we had to find these vocals. And I would every week go to different record stores, go to secondhand stores, go to thrift shops and rummage sales and flea markets. And you would figure out how to identify where great vocals might live, because you also couldn't listen to the record before you bought
right.
it. And so you'd be at a flea market and there'd be a crate of records. And like, clearly you're not going to be buying a Journey record or, you know, I don't know, like you're not buying something you already know. But when you spot the weird one, that's when you're like, okay, there might be something there. 9 times out of 10, there was nothing there. You get it home, you'd listen to it and be like, oh, okay, I can't use it, put it in the discard bin. But I bought this record in 1991 at the flea market in Chelsea. Now it's probably a giant condo, but back then it was on like 24th and 6th Avenue. And it was by the Shining Light Gospel Choir. And I'm sure you know what a vanity pressing is, but back then that was the Nay Plus Ultra of vinyl were vanity pressing. You know, so it wasn't on a record label. It was some person or organization pressed up 100 copies of a record in 1952, and somehow one ended up in this flea market. So the Shining Light Gospel Choir had made a vanity pressing in the 50s, and I took it home, and I was like, oh my God, these vocals are amazing. And I sampled Why Does My Heart Feel So Bad from this record, and I tried to write a techno track around it. And it was not good. Like the vocals were great, yeah. But it was 1992, the height of the rave scene. I was like, boom, 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 like 142 beats per minute. And I put the vocals on it and it just didn't work. About 6 years later, and I know I'm an old guy. I tell long stories. I apologize.
I'm right there with you.
6 years later, I had lost my record deal. I was bottoming out as an alcoholic. My mom had just died. But Daniel Miller, who owned Mute Records, was basically going to let me make one last record. And that record ended up being Play. But while I was working on it, like, I didn't expect anyone to listen to it. Like I said, I'd been dropped by Elektra in the United States. And I was reminded of those vocals. And I thought, okay, rather than try and push them into some mediocre techno track, why not try and write a song based around the vocals? And so that's how, so I sort of played with the different chords, you know, it's like A minor, E minor, G major, D major, and then C major, A minor, F major to C major. And the vocals, all of a sudden, it made sense. But it was an obscure recording, and I was making this record in my bedroom, so I never expected anyone to hear it, and was very surprised when it came out and people ended up liking it.
So was it more than Why Does My Heart that was inspired by or framed by one of the songs on that album, or were there several songs on that particular album that spawned several songs from the album Play?
No, the only song from that record, from the Shining Light Gospel Choir vanity pressing from 1952, I think in like Englewood, New Jersey, the only thing that made it onto Play was Why Does My Heart Feel So Bad? But now you've reminded me, I should probably go in my basement and find that record because there might be some other beautiful vocal gems.
Yeah, it's amazing how that happens. And just the way you described it, that you found this album years before and then it struck you and then it became this massive song that is so powerful. And it was just beautiful to hear it when you were playing in London again, too. And throughout that album, because there were so many different hits on that album, was it a similar kind of process, the way that you approached them?
Well, so what had happened was in 1996, I released an album called Animal Rights. Because when I was growing up, I thought part of a musician's job was to experiment and to make, at times, challenging, difficult records. You know, like Lou Reed made Metal Machine Music. John Lennon started the Plastic Ono Band. Neil Young made all sorts of experimental records. And so I was like, okay, I'm now a professional musician. Part of my job description is to go wherever you want to go creatively. And so I made this album, Animal Rights, which is a very, very challenging punk rock industrial record. And, oh, it failed. I mean, no one liked it apart from Axl Rose, Bono, and Terrence Trent D'Arby. They all three told me they liked it, but everyone else seemed to hate it. And as a result, I lost my record deal. And so when I was making Play, I never expected anything. Like, I was a has-been, 1998, 1999, complete has-been. And So I thought, okay, I'm going to make one more record, then I'll go back to teaching philosophy at a community college in New Hampshire. Yeah. And my first thought was to make an even darker record, because I was listening to a lot of Pantera and Sepultura. And
wow.
I was like, I'm going to make an even harder punk rock metal industrial record. And my manager said something so naive and simple. He said, you know what? I know you enjoy playing speed metal. He said, but the electronic music you make really makes people happy. And the reason that affected me is he didn't say the electronic music you make can sell well. The electronic music you make can generate revenue. He said it will make people happy. And I sort of thought to myself in that moment, you know what? The world is a challenging place. If you have the ability to make art that can actually reach people emotionally, why not try to do that?
Yeah.
You know, so I can play speed metal and punk rock in my spare time, but clearly I was making, speed metal and punk rock that wasn't making too many people happy. And I thought, why not try and create more melodic, emotional music that can actually reach people emotionally? So it was really that simple suggestion from my manager saying melodic emotional music reaches people emotionally.
Yeah, well, that song and the entire album certainly does that. And so on the song, the female vocalist is who?
Here's the interesting thing. The version on Play, the vocal sample, that's a man.
Right, there's the man, but then there's female background, isn't there?
No, it's just one voice, but I don't know who this person is from 1952 in Englewood, New Jersey. But it's just one, it's just the pastor at that church.
That's fascinating. It's fascinating. So you have this album that you had no expectations for whatsoever. And like you said, you were dropped by your record label before. So you didn't have any expectations, but then this comes out and it rockets up the charts and has this massive success. How does that change your life just emotionally? Like, how do you deal with that as a musician when everything changes?
As someone who grew up in love with Minor Threat, if you had asked me that question in 1999, I would have said, oh, fame is shallow and it doesn't matter. But at the time, I loved it so much. Like, suddenly I was being invited to big parties and I was touring and there were, you know, the audience size kept getting bigger. And then suddenly some money came in and I was able to buy an apartment. And like, I will say it, yeah, at the time it was great. But then of course, when you start, and it's happened countless times, when you start relying on external validation, when you start relying on alcohol and drugs, when you start relying on fame to bolster your emotional state, it goes wrong very quickly. Uh-huh. And so for me, 1999 was great. 2000 was really fun. Then the alcohol, the drugs, the reliance on the opinion of strangers, it all started to go wrong after that. And like so many people before me and sadly after me, I started chasing the dragon. So rather than say, okay, my well-being and my emotional stability should be the result of friends and family and creativity and spirituality and nature and health, I started doing more drugs and drinking more and desperately pursuing validation in the eyes of strangers.
Based on what you were just saying, it sounds like that was the transition of your life going into your next album. I think it was your next album, 18, where Extreme Ways is such an amazing song too. So is that right? You had gone into that path post-play and then going into 18. So your state of mind, was it very different at that point?
Yeah, I was kind of out of my mind, meaning with the album 18 and the album after that, Hotel, I was like, okay, I want to make music that I love. I want to make music that has integrity, but I also want to make music that keeps this machine going because I love it so much, you know? And I clearly, lots of other people have gone down that road. And sometimes you end up making good music, you know, even if your approach isn't as pure as it had been, you can still, good songs can come from it.
Well, Extreme Ways is amazing.
Yeah, I mean, like 18 has, I think, you know, a few special songs on it. And even Hotel, like the song Slipping Away from Hotel, like that's with some semblance of quasi-objectivity, I can say it's actually kind of a nice song, even though I was bottoming out as an alcoholic and a fame-obsessed drug addict when I wrote it.
God, that's fascinating. Because Slipping Away, I play that so many times. I'm a pretty sentimental guy, and so with my family and all that, like that is a song. Flipping Away is just a, there are so many songs that, because like I said, you know, your discography is near and dear, but that song in particular, and it's funny you say that you were at this point, almost like it sounds like you were trying to replicate a formula of some kind, but you're clearly a sentimental person because that song is deeply sentimental.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, that's what I mean, and it should be self-evident, but I guess sometimes it isn't, is that music should ideally, it should create its own world and communicate emotion. You know, the music I grew up in love with was music that was emotional. And it is interesting to me when I encounter music that has no emotional component, because to me, that's like encountering food without calories.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, but then again, I mean, emotion makes people uncomfortable, you know, and I understand a lot of musicians are probably deeply uncomfortable with the vulnerability that can come from emotional expression. So I don't know. I mean, it's not my place to criticize or judge other musicians, but there is a lot of music out there that definitely has no vulnerability to it. And as a result, a lot of that music just doesn't register for me.
Do you remember when Slipping Away first entered your brain? You know, a melody or a lyric?
I mean, it's interesting because that record, Hotel, weirdly, outside the United States and England, was very successful. Surprisingly successful. The biggest European hit I had was Lift Me Up, which was on that record.
Great song.
And so it's funny, if I was to If I was to play a show in the States and play Lift Me Up, that's when people would go to the bathroom or buy a snack.
It's such an amazing
where
song.
Where that's always sort of like, yeah, that's the encore in Europe. So, but the song Slipping Away, I'm trying to think where I was living on Mott Street. I wish I had a better story, but it was probably just as simple as like one day being hungover and depressed and playing acoustic guitar. And all of a sudden that song just popped out of my brain.
God, that's funny. And when songs pop out of your brain, Moby, are you able to, in a short period of time, organize it and create it? Or is it a long process for you?
It all depends. Sometimes it's immediate. Like sometimes the sort of the structure, I mean, because as we know, like especially in the world of Western song structure, oftentimes the structures are very simple. And so if you have an idea, you sort of understand, if you're conforming the idea to conventional Western song structure, you're not reinventing the wheel. Especially when, like, if you play in cover bands and you start realizing, like, the majority of iconic songs, apart from, like, Bohemian Rhapsody, the majority of them have very predictable conventional song structure. And sometimes the musicians have to almost give themselves license to use that conventional song structure and not make it overly baroque. You know, I think of, like, Feel Like Making Love by Bad Company. Three chords.
Yeah.
Helpless by Neil Young. Three chords. Sweet Home Alabama. Two chords. You know, like every song on Rumors by Fleetwood Mac. Like, I challenge you to find a song that has more than four chords on that. So, like, when you start to understand that if you're going to avail yourself of that conventional song structure, it oftentimes means not overcomplicating things, which makes, from the conception of a song to the execution of a song, sometimes you're like, well, yeah, maybe the chorus should be the exact same chords as the verse, just with a slightly different melody.
How about lyrics? Do you believe a kind of a thread of your process when it comes to lyrics, or is it all very idiosyncratic?
It's funny. I know a lot of people love writing lyrics. It's my least favorite part of the whole process for some reason. So I do it, and every now and then I think I come up with something that's not terrible. But for the most part, like, I think that there's a reason why I make a lot of instrumental music and work with other singers, because it's really nice when I don't have to write lyrics.
Yeah, gotcha.
Like, I'm glad when lyrics exist. I tried using ChatGPT, but the lyrics thus far it came up with were not remarkable. So
yeah.
But as a lazy songwriter, I love not being the person responsible for lyrics.
Interesting. You're talking about all this, and then, you know, we're fast forwarding a lot because there's so much living and music and art in between. But you have your latest album that was just recently released, Always Centered at Night. So what was your headspace going into this latest album and your process? How would you describe your process here as it compared to earlier in your life, as we were talking about?
Going back a little bit to getting sober, right before I got sober, I got the chance to hear David Lynch speak, and we talked about him having this sort of accidental tangential role in making the song go.
Yeah.
And so fast forward many, many years to 2008, and I was in England and I heard him speak, and he was being interviewed, and he said the simplest thing. He said, creativity is beautiful. And David, we've since become friends, he's he states things in very direct, simple ways. And the simplicity of that statement sort of was an epiphany to me, because I had been corrupted by the world. I was, you know, originally growing up as a musician, I wasn't even aware that music was a viable career path. But when it became a career path, I started thinking about how do I combine creativity with career? And the results for me, some people are very good at doing that. I was not good at doing that. So when David said creativity is beautiful, I just simply thought, oh, he's right. And that's the old, and I was just like, you know what? That's the only thing I should ever think about is the pursuit of art and creative expression simply for the potential that art and creative expression have to communicate beauty or to communicate emotion or ideas. And so I kind of made a deal with myself then. I got sober and I was like, you know what? I want to keep making music, but practically speaking, I'm retiring. You know, meaning I stopped thinking about commerce, which someone could be listening and be like, yeah, that's easy for you. You made money. I was like, yeah, of course, those were my circumstances. Like I didn't have to worry about paying the rent. So if you don't have to worry about paying the rent, why worry about paying the rent? You know, that was just, which might sound like privilege or entitlement, but it was to me just a statement of circumstance.
Yeah.
And so from 2008 until now, my approach to making music has simply been make music for the love of making music. And I did another thing is I stopped reading reviews and I stopped reading comments and I pretty much stopped touring unless I could raise money for charity. Because that, in a way, and I'm not saying that, that hopefully that doesn't sound like virtue signaling. It, to me, it keeps me pure.
Mm.
You know, so when I work on music, I'm not thinking about the reviews. I'm not thinking about revenue streams. I'm not thinking about accolade. I'm just thinking about the music itself and am I in love with it?
Mm-hmm.
And so with Always Centered at Night, I found myself over time really loving working with amazing vocalists who have incredibly unique voices. So the idea for Always Centered at Night was just to go into the world and find voices that I love and see if the people who own those voices would be willing to collaborate with me. And so, yeah, I found, you know, people who are at this point a little better known, but like Serpent with Feet, Lady Blackbird, Jose James, Gaida, who's an amazing singer from the Sudan, and a whole bunch of other people who simply have these phenomenal and unique phenomenal voices. So Always Entered Night is just me basically honoring their voices. Like I created the music, I maybe helped the lyrics a little bit, but for the most part, it's creating a platform for their voices to be remarkable.
Yeah, wonderful. That's great. And it's cool to hear just how you know, where you are at this point in your life too. And there's so much that we could dig into. You do have several books. Your photography, I know, is near and dear to you. I'm not going to even ask you about the state of the world today because we could go on and on. But your activism and what matters to you, clearly animal rights, your tour, like you said, all proceeds went to different animal rights organizations, which is wonderful. But and another thing that I saw that was really interesting to me, for some personal reasons too, but the Institute for Music and Neurologic Function and brain and how music impacts the brain and can healing and all of that. So you're involved in so many different things. Just how did that start? Like your animal activism, we'll start with that. How did that become such a central part of your life? And what are you focused on today?
Well, I grew up in a way that I assume many people grew up, which was I grew up surrounded by rescued animals. Yeah. You know, when I was growing up, we had rescued lab rats, we had rescued cats, rescued dogs, we had iguanas, we had mice, we had so many rescued animals. And I, from day one, I unconditionally loved all of our rescued animals. But I also grew up with the sort of like, the human paradox of I also loved Burger King and I loved going to McDonald's.
Yeah.
So like I would unconditionally love animals more than I loved humans, but then I would go eat pepperoni pizza without connecting the fact that, oh, loving animals while also eating dead animals who've been tortured and killed is, to state the obvious, inconsistent. And so when I was 19 in 1984, I suddenly realized, like, okay, if I don't want to be involved in causing animal suffering, I should stop supporting animal suffering. And so at first I went vegetarian, and then in 1987 went vegan. And as time has passed, that's become my focus. Like, that's my day job is waking up every day thinking, how can I create a world where animals don't suffer at the hands of humans?
Mm.
Like, that's my job. That's the thing I'm willing to die for. That's, you know, like, that to me is more important than anything else I could potentially do. And so part of that is strategy. It's figuring out, like, okay, for the last 100 or 1,000 years of animal rights activism, what works, what doesn't? And that's why I started this production company, Little Walnut, is to basically try and create content, films, TV, media, that is activist-oriented, but still interesting. Because as we know, there's a lot of activist content out there regarding any type of activism that no one wants to watch. And so it's, how do you tell stories and how do you create media and content with activist messages that people will actually pay attention to? So that's my day job. Making music is just something that I love unconditionally. But yeah, to me, music is almost more like a spiritual hobby at this point.
So tie that into your first features, your first scripted feature film that it will be seeing the light of day. I don't know when exactly, but I think it's in production right now. But tell us a little bit about that feature film.
Yeah, we just finished shooting, and it's a scripted feature with amazing talent, and Mark Weber's directing. Sarah Jeffries and Mina Marsoud are the two leads, and Mina was Aladdin in the movie Aladdin. Sarah was the lead of the show Charmed. So it's like, I hope it's going to be good.
It's called Tessie, T-E-C-I-E.
And the title will make sense once people see the movie.
Oh, okay.
I know it's a super weird name, and it's the Tessie is the chosen name of our lead male character.
Okay.
And yeah, hopefully it'll come out next year at some point. And hopefully it'll be good. And beyond that, it's a story. It's about, like, animal activists who fall in love and are these principled, attractive, dynamic people who just are so, they love each other and they have these amazing lives where they go to raves and they play in punk rock bands. But first and foremost, they're committed to, you know, making the world a kinder, better place.
Interesting. I look forward to seeing that. And then just finally, Moby, what are you listening to these days? What's on your playlist? And if there are any artists from any era that are particularly moving you at this moment in time?
Oh, boy. It's such a wonderful question, and I don't even know how to begin answering it, because my approach to making music and listening to music has always been eclectic, but the DSPs, whether it's SoundCloud, YouTube, Spotify, Apple Music, et cetera, they have taken my eclecticism and made it schizophrenic. Like, you know how every year Spotify will send you, like, here's the music you listen to. Mine, I feel like someone might want to institutionalize me at some point. Like, it's Debussy and Billie Holiday and Marvin Gaye, but also Pantera and Propane and Discharge. It's jungle and house music, but also Brian Eno. With a degree of shame, a lot of the music I grew up loving, I still listen to a lot. So it's...
There's no shame in that.
Echo and the Bunny... I feel like, though, I don't know, when I was young, I was like, I'm always going to only listen to new music. And now I listen to like Heaven Up Here by Echo and the Bunnymen and Closer by Joy Division and Rage in Eden by Ultravox or, you know, Happy Families by Blancmange, like my favorite records from 1981.
Yeah.
I'm still kind of listening to.
Well, those are great ones to listen to, by the way. So it was wonderful to have been able to be, you know, fortunate to have seen one of your few live shows in the first in over 10 years. And just listening to the music. I was listening to your new album earlier today. Love it. It's fun to listen to, just kind of the direction that it is. And so thank you very much for joining The Story Behind the Song. And also appreciate all the positivity that you're bringing on the activist front.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah, it was wonderful speaking with you. And I will say, as someone who's done interviews for a very long time, doing longer, more conversational interviews, which kind of like we started Moby Pod as a way of having these sort of conversations,
yeah,
like having actual conversations rather than showing up at a radio station in Tulsa and getting 30 seconds on air during drive time.
Yes.
Like this is a lot more satisfying. So thank you for taking the time and talking to me.
No, absolutely. I really enjoyed it.
That was multi-faceted artist and activist Moby telling his story behind the song Why Does My Heart, just one of many signature tracks from his album Play, which celebrates its 25th anniversary this year. I'm your host, Peter Chatti of Deep Cuts Media. Stay tuned each Monday for another episode of new interviews mixed with encore episodes of some of my favorites with the greatest artists of all time. Reach out to me at peter@deepcutsmedia.com if you want to add your own icons to the list. And make sure to like, subscribe, and share each episode and the show itself. Until next week, you can revisit all of my 40-plus interviews from seasons 1 and 2. The artists are legendary. Their stories are classic and timeless. And as always, thanks for listening to The Story Behind the Song.
An O'Reilly Auto Parts gift card is the perfect gift for that hard-to-buy-for person. Give the gift of convenience from O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at tanger.com.